I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
All right, so you guys know, if you've listened long enough to the show or to this podcast, with a huge Howard Stern fan, I was not a fan of the show so much anymore, more the heyday. It's the beauty of Stern is they actually have two channels now. They have the channel that gives you the Howard Stern of today, but then they give you the real Howard Stern, the one I grew up with. And a big part of that channel is Jackie Marling. He was the head writer, as he called himself, on the show for years and years and years and years. Then he left, and it was ugly, and then he came back a little bit again when serious, and then gone. And he's been sort of outside the Stern world, but I loved Jackie. I was a huge Jackie Marling fan, and it took a while. We got him to come on the podcast. He talks about a lot of stuff. He talks about Stern of today, talks about what it was like back then, talks about his career in comedy. And if you're a Howard Stern fan, a diehard Howard Stern aficionado, I think this one's a must-listen, just like the Artie Lang one is as well. If you haven't listened to that yet, go back and listen to it. Jackie Martling on Enough About Me.
So how many nights a year now would you say you do stand-up? Is it every weekend, couple days a week? How busy are you still?
It floats because sometimes I'll go like a week or two without working, but like I'm working both nights this weekend, nights the following weekend, I worked both nights last weekend. You know, I'm basically at the point where I say yes before the phone rings.
And you still, I mean, do you like it as much as you liked it 30 years ago?
You know what? Probably even more. It's really weird. You know, like a couple months ago, I worked for 2,500 people at the Orleans Arena, and then three nights later, I worked for 80 people in New Jersey, and I'm like, I enjoy them equally. It's, you know, you just enjoy it. You know, I don't do two shows in a night anymore because that's like telling somebody you got to have sex with a woman twice in a row. It spoils both of them. You know.
Well,
but.
Yeah.
But I do. I love it. And I do a lot of podcasts. I did Artie Lang's podcast last night. We just have such a good time, you know.
Were you ever a guy? So obviously I'm a huge Stern fan. I've had Artie on this podcast. I talk about Stern on our show a lot. Did you, and I was a huge fan when you were on the show, did you ever move out in L.A.? Were you ever a guy who went out there and tried? Were you always a New York comedian?
What I was, there was no such thing as comedy on Long Island. And when I quit music in 1978, we started doing comedy on Long Island, and I started making my own albums. And I was never a guy that even went into New York City. You know, I never went and did Catch a Rising Star and the comic strip and all those. I went to the comic strip just long enough to pass the audition. I went to Catch a Rising Star just to go up and be frightened to death. But for the most part, I produced shows on Long Island and then ran comedy clubs on Long Island and put out my own albums, and then Howard got a hold of my albums, and we went to Pluto.
So
I never even played the game in New York City, let alone Los Angeles.
What years are we talking about, though, when you're starting comedy out in Long Island? Is that like early 80s, late 70s?
1979. There was no such thing as comedy clubs, and we did a comedy show at a restaurant that was owned by Jerry Cooney, the boxer,
the fighter,
owned by his brother. And it was so successful, it blossomed into the East Side Comedy Club. And then like a year later, they asked me to open Governor's Comedy Shop in Levittown, which is still going. And along the way, I was producing shows and making my own records. And in 1982, I sent my three records to this guy that was coming to New York City that they said was very wild. And he loved my albums and asked me to come join them on the air, and then I stuck to him like bubblegum to somebody's foot.
So you weren't around like the other Long Island comedians at that time, like, say, Eddie Murphy or Jerry Seinfeld?
When I started,
right.
The reason we started our own comedy show at the restaurant is because we worked at a place called Richard M. Dixon's White House Inn, and it was Eddie Murphy, Bob Nelson, Rob Bartlett, and me and Richie Minervini, and we were all working these crap hole gigs. In fact, when I broke up with my band, I used to play by myself with my guitar and my amplifier in bars. And there was no place to go on stage. So those guys used to come to my guitar gigs, like Eddie Murphy and Bob Nelson, because they could get up and do 5 or 10 minutes at my shows. And we had such a good time. You know, it was so fledgling. And then, of course, Eddie took off like a rocket, like, you know, zoom. But, it's funny. Yeah, like Eddie came up to me one day and said, Jack, you have a comedy album. I want to have a comedy album. And I said, I'm sorry, Eddie. I'm too busy.
Good move. Shrewd.
Famous last words.
When do you start writing for Rodney Dangerfield? How does that happen?
That is the greatest story. I got a book coming out in about 6 or 8 months.
Really?
But what happened was the reason I got to write for Rodney was because a friend of mine told me a lie.
Okay. All right.
The guy Richie Minervini, who floats in and out of my life all along, now he's opening act for Kevin James and best friends with him, and he's in all his movies. Me and Richie are the ones that started the show at this place, Cinnamon, and he became the owner of the East Side Comedy Club, and he's an icon in Long Island comedy. But when we were just starting out, you know, we were all struggling. We were all so full of crap. And he walked in one night. I was living at my grandmother's house after she died. And so he was crashing with me. And he came in and said, oh, man, I went on a Dangerfield tonight. And Rodney loved me. And he told me he's going to put me on TV, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, holy mackerel. So I sat down and went through all my old jokes and translated, you know, my jokes, the ones I thought would fit Rodney, into Rodney's voice, and I typed up 6 pages, and then when Richie came home the next night, I said, Richie, you know, give these pages to your friend Rodney Dangerfield. And he said, oh, man, you know, I went there. I didn't get on stage, and Rodney wasn't there. He had totally made up the whole thing.
All bullshit?
All bullshit. And he said to me, but you know what? He said, I really was there, and I swear to God, he hands me a matchbook that said Dangerfield, and, you know, the classic caricature of Rodney pulling on his tie and the address. And I had already typed up the pages, and I put the pages in an envelope and put Rodney Dangerfield with the address of the club and just mailed it. I had nothing to lose.
Right.
And 2 days later, the phone rings, and I'm at my grandmother's house. She had died. Nobody had the number. So there was nobody calling. Her friends were all dead. And if the phone rang, it was very weird. But, of course, I had put that phone number in the letter. So the phone rings. I'm with my girlfriend having lunch, and I answer the phone. Hello? I said, who is this? And he said, it's Rodney. And I said, Rodney who? And he says, I knew you were funny. I knew you were friggin' funny. I could tell right away you're funny. You know?
Right,
and then my girlfriend says, who is it? I said, it's Rodney Dangerfield. And she said, bull crap. Who is it, Richie? I said, it's Rodney. He said, yeah, a lot of funny stuff here. And I wound up giving him the best joke, he said, that he ever had. It was an old Southern expression that somebody called me up in the middle of the night and told me, and it was just the greatest line, and it fit him like a glove. And he always said, yeah, it's the funniest joke I ever had, you know? And it was the two-bagger joke.
Right.
Are you familiar with that?
I'm familiar because I remember the great Rodney appearance on the Stern Show with you guys.
Oh, and that whole story, I explained that whole story in my book, because that was such a fabrication. It was the greatest radio in
the
world. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
What do you mean?
You know,
like,
the concept, if you owe somebody $200
right.
and he mows lawns for $100 a week, you know what I mean? And
it's
simple barter, you
right.
know? And he bought jokes for $50 a piece. You know, the whole thing is explained. But it was so funny because I had written to him and asked him to borrow another $2,000, and he never even responded to my letter. And by the time we got done with that radio show, Howard had me owing him $3,000.
But the thing is, but
called me up, and I went to see him at Westbury, and I wound up going on the road with him, and it all came out of a lie.
but it's funny though, like the way you mentioned, you wrote obviously jokes. You know when you write jokes for Stern, you understood the way he talked. A joke like that for Rodney Dangerfield, the two bag joke. That doesn't work for, say, Richard Lewis. Like, you have to write the joke for the right comedian.
You know, comedy writing is, everything is old. I'm a student of comedy, believe it or not, and I no more jokes than anybody in the world, and there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, if you think you can write something about sex or duty or farts or puking that hasn't been said since the time of Adam and Eve, that forget about the egotism of thinking that. You know, but you got to hear it in his voice. Like a lot of the things I wrote for Howard to say wouldn't have been funny coming from anybody else. And they weren't even jokes. They were just words, lines, you know, concepts. You know, I got into his head. You know, we were sharing a brain for a lot of years, you know?
How did you wind up going from a guy who's a comedian to the Howard Stern Show full-time as the head writer?
It was so organic that it's hard to explain. Like, I went in there and sat in there with them for a radio show. They called me up and said, listen, we're doing a talent contest over the phone. We listen to your records. We think you're really funny. Would you like to come in? And I said, sure. You know, I was in my mother's attic when I answered the phone.
Right,
you know.
Right.
So I went in, and I sat there, and it was me, Howard, Robin, and Fred, the same as the last day I was on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat there and laughed our asses off for 4 hours. And at the end of the day, he looked over at me and said, man, you're a lot of fun. Why don't you come in next week? So I came in once a week for 3 years for free. But slowly but surely, I would, like, hand him some ideas. The first kind of things I handed him were ideas that we had. It was a traffic reporter called Mama Look a Boo Boo Day.
Right, I remember it.
Who was a black traffic reporter in a helicopter, and he did it with a megaphone. You know, I gave him some obnoxious stuff that, you know, in the black voice, and he was kind of weird about taking it, and then he really loved it. And then slowly but surely, I would, like, kind of hand him ideas. But it was so gradual. By the end of the 3 years, I had, you know, he got fired and then got rehired. And when he got rehired, I still was coming in one day a week and still slowly but surely handing him stuff. And then one day he called up and said, listen, we're going to mornings starting on Monday. And Kirk, this is what's so funny. In all the millions of dollars I made and as many markets as we're in and as huge as the radio show was, my entire job description, he called me up and said, listen, we're going mornings on Monday. I want you to come in 2 days a week and do your thing with the notes. That was my entire job description. That's as much as we ever discussed it. We started on Monday. I was there for 2 days a week, slipping him notes. And he was much funnier when I was there. So I went to 3 to 4. Within like 2 months, I was there 5 days a week. They had to expand the budget. And by, I would say, May of 1986, I was there 5 days a week. In August, we syndicated to Philadelphia and Washington, and then we went to Pluto.
And did you, you know, did you enjoy it the whole? I mean, we'll talk about the end in a couple of minutes, but did you enjoy?
No, I enjoyed every second of every day. Even when they were torturing me, you know, there was ups and downs, but it was like, what really was hard was how hard it was on your life. You didn't have a life outside because it was just you were exhausted all the time.
Sure, I do. My show's 6A, same 6A to 10A every day. Your life
and
by
people don't understand. Doing it, they don't understand.
By Thursday, you're a puddle. You know, you can't even think.
I didn't have it together to go to sleep and take a nap.
Yeah, you have to do that.
You know what's really funny is here I am making all this money, and I would have still been there if I had together to take a nap, but I couldn't take a nap. And now I'm 68 years old, and all I want to do is take a nap. When I wake up in the morning, I swear to God, the first thing I think about is when I'm going to get to lie down again.
It seems to me, though, like, you know, when they got back, so you left. Whatever, I think it was around 2001. There's some contract issues, whatever it was. It was obviously talked about a lot on the show. You left, and then you were gone for a while, and Howard really buried you when you left. I mean, he kind of kicked the shit out of you. I'm sure
it was so unfair. What it was imagine you had a job,
mm-hmm.
and you thought you deserved more money, and you asked the boss for more money, and he said no, so
I've
you
done
left.
That. Right.
That was the total thing. It wasn't, I want more billing. I want a limousine, I want to be treated better, I want more credit. It was, I thought I deserved more money, and they didn't.
Well, Howard.
A huge raise,
right.
But it wasn't what I wanted because I had drawn a line in the sand. It was like, if I'm going to stay awake, you know, if I'm going to wreck my life for 5 more years, this is what I'd like to make. And I'm full of crap, too, because a couple months later I called up and said, listen, I'll take the offer that you made me.
And they said no.
And they didn't say no.
No. Oh, what
they
happened?
They never responded.
They never
called back.
Well, that's kind of saying no, Jackie. That's sort of the
same
thing.
Well, it's saying no, but it's also pretty rude.
No, I agree with that. But Stern talks about it being, you know, mind-blowing money. He couldn't believe you turned it down. I mean, are we talking, you know, $1 million?
You know what? I'm not telling you how much it was, but I would say it's probably one-third what anybody thinks it was. I'll tell you, in the mid-90s, I was making $300,000, and I wanted $400,000, and I was holding out, and nobody knew. And Dominic Barber called me up and said, "Jackie, what are you doing? You got to get back on that show. You know, why are you holding out?" So, and when I told him what we're talking about, he had to pull over.
I got to tell you, that's
the whole world thought that I was making $1.5 million, and I was holding out for $2.5 million. When I told him it was for an extra $100,000, he said, "What is Mel out of his mind? What is he doing? They were about to lose, you know." And I was relatively important to the show. It depends on who you talk to.
No, I agree that you were. And I would say, you know, so I'm on a morning show in Boston, and the show is really successful, does really well. It's in a couple, you know, we're in Providence and we're in Portland and we do well in several markets.
I just have to tell you how much I love Boston. I was just up there for the weekend last weekend.
Yeah.
And I love it.
And I make a damn good living. And how many markets did you say you were in 95 and 96, 96?
We were in 55 markets.
And number one in a lot of them, right?
Yeah. You know, they were printing money.
That's wild.
And you know, the amount of money I was asking for, I didn't ask for so much money. Like if somebody says, "Do you want to work in Alaska?" You don't say no. You say, "I want $100,000. That way, if they pay you that much money, you're going to go to all that hassle.
Right.
You know, you don't say no. But I gave them a figure that was absolutely fair. But I was the only one on that show that ever asked for more. No, everybody just takes what they're handed.
Well, not Howard. Even Stern back then?
No. The point is he gets it all, you know, and he deserves everything he has. And I never had any animosity towards that, but just share a little bit of it. You know what I was asking for? Like, you know, some listener did some kind of thing that they wrote, like, if you gave Jackie X amount, it'd be like one penny out of, you know, one of those comparisons.
Right.
But, you know, it was so weird. They really hung me upside down and cut my guts out for just, you know, for asking for more money.
Now, so you left, and then, you know, when they came back to see, you were on the last, you know, right before they left Terrestrial, they went to Sirius, and you were kind of in the mix for a while. You were in studio a couple of times. You were at a couple of roasts. You were having a good time. And then you went away. I feel like there's been another falling out. Is that accurate?
No, they just didn't call me anymore. You know, like the last time I was on, Gary called up. I guess Robin had a book out, and they asked me to read from Robin's book. And, you know, and I went in, and I had a good time in there. You know, I guess they just have nothing to say to me, or who knows, you know. But it wasn't like something happened.
Don't you find that odd, though? Like, you worked with these guys forever, every day. I know what it's like when you're in the middle of a radio show, every day, and then to be totally cut out. Like, do you talk to Howard at all ever off the air?
Now, listen. I worked with the guy 18 years, and then he didn't invite me to his wedding. Now, do that math. Just do that math. You know, he's an odd guy. But if he was, you know, but I don't hold that against him, because if he wasn't the kind of guy he is, he wouldn't be the guy he is. Do you know what I'm saying?
Sure, but do you buy this? You know, obviously you were on the podcast with Artie. I'm sure you've paid attention to Artie lately. He was on my podcast. He was critical of Howard. I mean, do you buy this idea that there's this sort of new figure in his life, this Marcy Turk, and that he's changed, and he's sort of...
You know, I hear everything. You know, I hear everything because everybody thinks I'm so interested. And that whole thing just really has me boondoggled, like how it came about and all that stuff. It just sounds so weird. Am I totally shocked? No. But, you know, what the hell's going on? And, you know, and everything that happens just happens because nobody says anything. You know what I mean?
What do you mean by that?
And nobody says, "Hey, are you sure we should do this, or do you really want to do this?" It's, you know, I can't comment it because I'm not there and I don't know anything.
Well, do you listen to the show now?
I didn't listen to the show before I was on it. I didn't listen to the show when I was on it, and I don't listen. I've never listened to 10 seconds of the show.
Is that true? You've not listened to the show since you left?
I never listened. You know, people. There's so many things about it. I tell people that I don't watch porn. They don't believe that. I tell people I don't enjoy strip clubs. They don't believe that. I tell people I don't listen to the show. They don't believe that. It's like, I don't care, but what's in it for me to lie, you know?
No, I just find it sort of psychologically it's interesting. You're part of something, you know, for 18 years, and then you can just walk away from it, I think is kind of interesting.
There's no upside. If it's funny, I'll feel bad, and if it's not funny, I'll feel bad.
Right. That's true. But you don't talk to Robin or Gary or Fred or anybody?
Fred and I went to lunch a couple years ago. you know, it seems like yesterday, but it was like 2 years ago. And I had lunch with Robin maybe 6 months ago. You know, I mean, there's no animosity. You know, it's fine. But I'm just not part of them whatsoever.
Yes.
But, I don't get a lot of it. I had a show on Stern 101
for
8 years.
Yeah, Jackie's Joke Hunt.
Yeah, and it was great fun. Everybody loved it. And then 1 year, just before Thanksgiving, they pulled the plug on the show, and me and my partner weren't invited to the Christmas party.
But I guess, Jackie, I guess what I'm saying there is, so if I have a relationship with a guy I worked with who's a powerful guy who has his own two stations, is making $500 million, I've known for a long time, if that happens, I feel like I can at least pick up the phone and say, hey, can you put in a word? And if you can't, and if it doesn't work out, fine, but can you at least do that for me? I feel like I've done enough for your career that you might want to do that for me.
He's the one that pulled the plug on the show.
Well, why?
I was never given any explanation.
You didn't feel compelled to call him and ask?
Listen, me and my partner, we're on Sirius 101, Howard 101,
yep,
for 8 years.
Yep.
Okay? And then they had a Sirius XM event for Howard's 60th birthday.
Right.
Not only were we on Sirius, we were on one of Howard's channels.
Yep.
And they threw him a 60th birthday party, and we were not invited to the birthday party.
That's strange.
How do you deal with that? What do you ask? Who do you ask?
It's so
slam in the face, you know. I honestly think if he had a birthday party and one person came up to him and said, Howard, man, it's really great to see Jackie again, that would wreck his day.
Why is that, do you think?
I swear to God.
Why do you think that?
I don't know. Why would you not invite us? You know, we're part of a team, you know.
It is strange. But I mean, yeah. But
you know, the hard part is
yeah,
30
yeah.
people, 30 people called me up and said, can I be your plus one at the 60th birthday party? And I had to tell them I wasn't invited, and my friends didn't believe me.
Well, it was an odd group of celebrities, and that's my – listen, nobody was a big – people say this to you, I'm sure, all the time, but I was the biggest Stern fan going. You know, came on here at BCN in Boston, and I rode it all the way. And now when I listen to Howard, and there's some things he still does really well, but he's just not the same guy that I liked 20 years ago. Now, that's part of getting older, I guess. But I don't want to sit there and listen to Howard Stern.
A lot of people say it's so much better than it ever was.
Right.
Other people say it was never good.
Right.
People say it wasn't good after I left. People say it wasn't good after Billy left. You know.
No, sure.
Everybody has
Artie,
their own opinion.
Yeah, right. But I'd rather listen to them, you know. I'd rather listen to Jackie Puppet break Conan O'Brien's balls than Howard talk to Sarah Jessica Parker about her acting process.
And,
I mean, that's,
you know,
that's
just and everybody says that. Not everybody. You know, a lot of people say that. Of course, write me, the Stern Show, it really became good the day you left. And,
sure.
You know.
And Artie was great. Artie was fantastic.
But, yeah, it's like, it's so funny that people are like I did Artie's podcast last night, and we're really good friends. We're going to do some shows together, which is going to be great fun. And, but, you know, people are like, oh, it's good to see you guys getting along again. People don't realize that I left the show in March. He didn't start on the show till 8 months later.
Right,
there was no crossover whatsoever.
Right. But
we had nothing to do with each other.
But here's the thing, though. I feel like with Stern, whether it's you or John or Artie or KC, it's just a listener of the show, it seems like nobody leaves well. It never ends well.
Well, he's Trump. It's never his fault.
What do you mean?
It's like everybody, Billy West left because
Billy
they
West.
Wouldn't pay him.
Right.
They wouldn't pay him. You know, I mean, it always comes down to money, you know, like if they could have given me what I asked for and not even sneezed, you know what I mean? So who knows what,
Was there part of you though that like, if you, you know, did you look at it at the time and say, okay, fine, I'm not getting the money I want from K-Rock or from the company themselves, but I make X amount more on the stand-up circuit because I'm on Stern.
No. There was no rationale to what I did. I was stuck in my marriage.
Right.
I was stuck in booze. I was stuck in the show, and I was miserable. And I had to break the chain. And it was I got divorced, quit the show, quit drinking, and moved into a house by myself, all at the same time.
Right.
And it was crazy, but that was the only thing I had to do. You know, I didn't want to go on. You know, there were all kinds of factors. I knew if I stayed on the show, I was going to have to do a divorce that played out in front of millions of people. I wasn't thrilled about that. You know, everybody's like, oh, Nancy left you after you lost your job. That's supposed to, you know.
Right.
Me and her, she lives two doors away from me. She's my best friend. You know what I mean? But I was just stuck in a weird thing. And I knew I would never quit drinking. And I don't even know how much. There was no rationale. It was just like something where I said, you know what? I'm going to do this. If I get this money, I'll stay. If I don't, I'm leaving. And I'll deal with it then.
Was there ever
if I had sat down, you know, I sit here once in a while. I look at my house and say, imagine if I had $10 million, what my house would look like.
Right.
But I'd still be swimming in the Long Island Sound. I'd still be smoking a joint and having the time of my life, like I was in the 70s.
But is that true? Was there when you stopped doing the Stern Show? Was there did your stand up price go down?
No, it was decimated. I make a fraction, not even a fraction of what I used to make.
Yeah.
But I'm used to that. You know, I told the jokes in 1979 for one price, and then I told them in 1994 for a different price, and now I'm telling back for the 79 price. You know, that's how it works. There was no calculating. You know, I wasn't calculating my career. I was negotiating basically for my life, not my career.
There was a point, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s, it seemed like there was a comedy. It seemed like the explosion, right? There was a stand-up comedy club in every city in America, three.
There were none.
Right.
There were none in 1979, and we created the East Side Comedy Club on Long Island, and then Governors, and the Brokerage. And in the few years that I was working at those places, it blossomed to where it became a glut.
Yeah.
You know?
But now it feels like we're sort of, you know, not where we were 40 or 30 years ago, but it feels like there's a lot less than there were, say, 20 years ago.
Yeah, it kind of leveled out. You know, I tell people, like, in the 70s, if you turned on the TV and you saw a stand-up comedian, you locked on that station. You just sat on that station and watched.
Right.
In the 80s, if you turned on a TV and saw a stand-up comedian, you couldn't turn the channel fast enough.
It's true.
You know
true.
What I mean? It went 180, you know. It's been an incredible ride. I love it, you know.
And you're still, where are you going to be, like, say, when are you in the Boston area again? When can we see Jackie, the Joke Man, in Boston?
I'll tell you one thing that kills people is I just got a book deal, and the agent for my book told me the first phone call he ever made as a little kid on Long Island was to my dirty joke line. I've had 516-922-WINE since 1979 when we first started comedy clubs.
Yeah.
You know, when we first started that comedy show at that restaurant, we had no money, so I made a joke line with dirty jokes, and I've had it going for 37 years.
Jesus.
37 years.
Jesus.
And I still have my Jokeland email list. I send jokes, and I tweet a joke every day at 4:20.
Yep.
At Jackie Martling, if any of your listeners like dirty jokes.
Absolutely.
Or even stupid jokes.
I follow you. Yep.
At Jackie Martling. And I was just in Boston. We did Comedy for a Cause Plymouth. I saw Plymouth Rock.
Yeah,
that
right.
was very exciting.
Oh, Lenny was there, right?
Yeah, Lenny Clark and me are dear, dear old friends. And then the next night I did his Brothers Club Giggles in Saugus.
Uh-huh.
Johnny Peasy's Club Laugh Out Loud up in North Andover.
Mm-hmm.
I love Boston. My last album was recorded at Giggles, and one of my albums in the 90s was recorded at the Comedy Palace in Andover, which was not a palace.
No, it is not. It is not.
No,
it is not.
And I should be back in Boston very soon. I work all over Connecticut, you know. But, you know, my gigs are very, very varied, you know, and I love that.
Yeah.
You know, like this weekend, I'm working a private party for stupid money for some, you know, the fans from the 80s, a lot of them are now rich.
Right, they're older, they're in their money-making years now.
Right.
Right.
And I'm working at Han Yonkers, and then where am I going? I'm, I'm all over the place.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate you coming on, Jackie, and I'm still holding out hope that I'm going to hear you on with Howard sometime soon.
You know, it's really weird. I don't know what's going on there, you know, but it's as simple as he could call me up one day and say, hey, why don't you come in tomorrow? I mean, it could happen, you know, like, it's not going to,
yeah,
but it could, you know. It's very interesting, you know.
It is. All right, well, Jack,
it's
again.
It's funny because if he mentions my name on the air.
It blows up, right?
I'll get 10 phone calls. 5 of them will say, Howard was talking such nice stuff about you. And the other 5 people say, Howard was talking crap about you. And they're listening to the same thing.
The Jackie Puppet was the greatest, though. That episode with fucking Conan, when the Jackie Puppet was destroying Conan and Conan was melting in studio with Billy West, was unbelievable.
You know, if you follow the timeline, go follow the timeline and see if Trump, the insult dog, didn't come directly out of that appearance.
Follow the
timeline.
That's interesting. I never thought of that. With Smigel,
I think those guys listened and said, listen, that puppet can say anything. You can't get mad at the puppet. You know, I'm not saying it's a very obvious idea. It's the idea, you know,
right.
You know, Edgar Bergen's puppet could insult people. You know,
right.
Charlie McCarthy could say anything.
Right,
you know?
Right.
In
the yeah. But there must be part of you that misses the day in, day out breaking balls part of that show.
No. I tell people I don't miss the money or the fame or any of that. Nowhere near as much. The thing that you miss is for 5 days a week, for 5 hours a day, I was in a room with the funniest people in the world, and we just laughed for 5 hours. You miss that. I couldn't believe how much I missed that.
You
just don't have that in real life.
You couldn't go wrong.
You know, once in a blue moon, you're in the green room with 3 other comedians laughing your asses off.
Right.
I had that 5 days a week for 15 years.
And you were the greatest because, you know, it would be like, whatever, 9:45 or something, and the show was kind of slowing down. And Robin would say something, and Fred or Howard would do the Jackie voice, and then they'd be off to the races, and they would just break your balls for a half hour.
Oh, it was, you know, and you know what people used to say to me, how do you let him say what he says to you? And I say, listen, try and wrap your brain around this. A lot of the insults that he said to me, I wrote.
You wrote, right? You would write
now,
them.
And people can't conceive of that. It's like Curly saying, Mo, why don't you hit me now?
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, Jack, I appreciate it. And let us know. Tweet out next time you're in Boston. We'll definitely make sure people go out and see you, as always.
Well, do me a favor. Make sure your guy sends me a street address, and I'll send you a pile of Jokeland stuff. And next time in Boston, maybe I'll call in and we
absolutely.
Can
yeah, we'll bring you in. That's awesome. All right, Jack. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you, buddy. Bye-bye.
See you. All right. Thanks again for listening to the Enough About Me podcast. Actually, you know what? I'm really not thankful at all. You should be thanking me. You get this shit every week, these great podcasts, totally free. Do me a favor. Would you go to iTunes, download it, go to Stitcher, do the same, and leave a rating, leave a review. That's where you can help me out. This podcast is going to be number one again. I guarantee it. And you're going to help me along with the process. So for that, I guess at the end, maybe I will thank you. There's a lot of thank yous going back and forth. Here's the point. Fuck you.
What up, y'all? It's your boy Danny Green, 3-time NBA champ. You either rooted for me or rooted against me. Join myself and my co-host Harrison Sanford on the Inside the Green Room podcast.
It's a podcast that brings you never-before-told tales from the locker room to candid interviews with basketball legends to breakdowns of what's happening in the NBA right now. Whether you're a diehard fan or casual about your hoops, this podcast brings you the game like never before.
Follow Inside the Green Room on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.